Right, I'm going to start off with something not too serious. What do you think the nation's favourite biscuit is? What do you think? Chocolate digestive. No, that comes in at number five. No, doesn't even reach the top five. Who said shortbread? Shortbread comes in at number two. Bourbon comes in at number three. Malted milk doesn't even meet. Nope. I'll let you know that the top one is a controversial one. There's a. As soon as I said controversial, you said Jaffa cake. It is Jaffa cake. Now, who thinks a Jaffa cake is not a biscuit? Who thinks it is? Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you. I think it's a biscuit. I said this at home to my wife, Suzette, and she said, it's a cake, it's not a biscuit. Now, okay, so what was the second most... If Jaffa cake's a cake, what's the nation's favourite biscuit? And you said it. Can you remember? Shortbread. And actually, shortbread is my favourite biscuit, as you can tell. Now, that was quite trivial, really. Anyway, just while we're thinking about the Queen, does anybody know what the Queen's favourite biscuit might have been? I never heard of it. I never heard of this biscuit, but then I'm not posh. Anyone want to guess? Anybody heard of a chocolate Oliver? What on earth's a chocolate Oliver? Anybody know? It's kind of a little chocolate biscuit. So basically, the Queen was a chocoholic. Who else here is a chocoholic? Yeah. Well, that was a bit trivial, really. But we're going to talk about favoritism. Who's ever been on the negative side of favoritism? I bet the truth is, most of us, at one point in our very short lives, especially John, very short life, aren't you, John? I've experienced some sort of favoritism on a negative side. How did it feel? Anybody? Not good. Horrible. Dispiriting. That's right. If you feel somebody's getting favored over you, it's pretty soul-destroying, isn't it? Well, I'm going to talk about favoritism today, but I'm going to mix in my little talk with today's Bible reading, which is taken from Genesis chapter 37. I'm going to start reading from verses 1 to 12, which you can find on page 41 of your church Bibles. And I found this in... Is this meant to be in here? Yes. Oh, just checking, that's all. Right. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of corn out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered round mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." when he told his father as well as his brothers. His father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze the father's flocks near Shechem. And we'll stop there for a moment. Think about that passage. In Joseph's day, everybody had a robe or a cloak. Robes were used for warmth, to bundle up belongings for a trip, to wrap babies in, to sit on, or even serve as security for a loan. Most robes were knee-length, short-sleeved, and plain. In contrast, Joseph's robe was probably the kind worn by royalty, long-sleeved, ankle-length, and extremely colorful. The robe became a symbol of Jacob's favoritism towards Joseph and aggravated the already strained relationship between Joseph and his brothers. Maybe Joseph walked around pretending to be a king, which really would have cheesed them off. How would you have felt if your brother was walking around lording it over you with fancy clothing? But as we read on, it didn't go well. I'm going to pick up the passage at verse 18, which is still on page 41. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan, but they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of those cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into a cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. Now that's quite a, I think that's quite a harrowing story near the end, actually, when they sold him into slavery. Now, I remember being at school, and I like watching sport, but I'm useless at playing sport. And I always maintain, now I'm talking in the 70s here, I maintain that games teachers had favourites. I was hopeless at sport, and so when the favourites, who were the ones who were good at football, were made team captains in the games lesson, and they were told to pick a team. "We'll have him, we'll have him, we'll have him." And there was me left with a person who was probably carrying a few extra pounds. And there was me. "Oh, we better have Maguire then. Better have him." Not a nice feeling. I see people, a few people grinning there because they can relate to that. But I got my own back because I'm not bad at art. And in the art lesson, the art teacher favoured me a little bit. He said, "You use your brain and you use your imagination." So I got an easel. All the rest had to draw on paper on their desks, and there was me and my easel. And then these lads who would shout at me on the football pitch because I wasn't very good at football, they'd come to me when the teacher wasn't looking. Hello. They came to me, the teacher wasn't looking, and they'd say, "Will you draw us this picture? Because I'm not very good. Will you draw this picture?" And I did draw them a picture, but I drew them a picture that would get them into trouble. Okay, was I right? Probably not. I was on the receiving end of favoritism. and also the negative side. And I suppose my response wasn't very good. At least I wasn't tempted to sell my classmates off into slavery. As we can see by the passage, Joseph's brothers were already angry over the possibility of being ruled by their little brother. And with his boastful attitude and manner, it was the last straw, and he was sold into slavery. Now, with hindsight, we can see God's plan through the story of Joseph, but at the time it wasn't obvious. It's the same today. It may be all very, very well some well-meaning Christian saying to us, it's all part of God's big plan, you know, that someone in your family is treated better than you, or you're passed over for promotion for somebody less talented at work just because the boss favors them. Somebody saying that to you, it's God's big plan, you know, isn't really helpful, especially when you're in that situation and you don't have the benefit of hindsight. Going back to the story, 10 men were willing to kill their brother over a robe and a few reported dreams. Their deep jealousy had grown into an ugly rage, completely binding them to what was right. Jealousy can be difficult to recognize because our reasons for it can seem or make sense at the time. We're justified, you know. But left unchecked, jealousy grows quickly and leads to serious sins. The longer we cultivate jealous feelings, the harder it is to uproot them. The time to deal with jealousy is when you notice yourself keeping score of what others have. I've done that. Have you ever kept score of somebody's favorite in your family or at work? Oh, they get this and they get that. You start keeping score. That's the time to think, hang on a minute, there's something wrong here. But jealousy can go deeper than that. It all boils down to, where do we get our self-worth, significance, or security from? Do you live your whole life getting these from other people, trying to please other people, trying to impress other people? Or do we get it from God? Again, you may say that's easier said than done. We're told at church week in, week out, that God loves everyone the same, that he favors everyone. We're all special and unique in his eyes. That is true. But deep down, do we feel it at times? Do we feel it? God, through Jesus, wants a personal relationship with us. It's not just reading about him in the Bible or undergoing some academic exercise. He wants and will give us the full experience of his presence if we let him. Now, one of the benefits of being married to a fellow Church Army officer, not to be confused with Salvation Army, and a trained spiritual director who's led many quiet days and retreats, is that I've picked up many tips on how to deepen my relationship with God. I'm going to tell you one that works for me. It might not work for you, but it's worth giving it a go. This is my morning cup of tea with God. Most mornings when I get up, I sit downstairs facing the garden, looking out over the garden, and I quietly drink a cup of tea. There's no TV on. There's no radio on. There's no smartphone on. There's no computer on. Just complete silence. I don't even read anything. Now, in that silence, I have no agenda but just to bathe in the presence of God. I try to listen to his soft, still voice. He may speak to me, more often he doesn't, but I do feel his peace and his love. Now, I know a lot of people don't do silence or are uncomfortable with silence. I would ask the question, why is that? Silence can be scary because you never know what God might say. To be in a relationship with someone doesn't always involve words to know that they're there. And through that time, I often feel sustained and ready for the day ahead. Not always, but it happens quite a lot. For me, it's a way of learning that our self-worth comes from him and not others. And I know at this time with the Queen's death, it can be quite a difficult time for people, and it can bring up feelings of when they lost loved ones in their life. And you can feel that the world is in such change, especially with the cost of living crisis and everything else that's going with it. So maybe it's a time to just draw back and listen to God and to bathe in his presence, because after all, he is the creator of everything around us. Oh, and all it takes is the time it takes to drink a cup of tea in complete silence. Now, a morning cup of tea with God might not work. What about an evening cup of cocoa with God? Or a double scotch, or whatever is your Just try whatever suits you. Time of the day, just sit and be with God and have a drink and see what happens. And finally, if we go back to Joseph, as a youngster, he was overconfident. His natural self-assurance, increased by being Jacob's favorite son, and by knowing of God's design on his life, made it unbearable to his 10 brothers. But this self-assurance, molded by pain and combined with a personal relationship and knowledge of God, maybe he had a morning cup of wine with God, I don't know, allowed him to survive and prosper when most have failed. In the coming weeks, we'll learn how he added quiet wisdom and won the hearts of everyone he met. Perhaps you can identify with one or more of his hardships, not just favoritism. But when you're facing a setback in life, the beginning of a Joseph-like attitude in life is to acknowledge that God is with us and there's nothing like his presence to shed new light on dark situations, especially as what the nation's been going through in the last week or so. Amen.